This is an ABC podcast.
In the financial district of London, there's a little lane called Leadenhall Street. A few centuries ago, this was the site of a modest building, a narrow-fronted company headquarters that was really easy to walk past without even noticing. If you walked inside, you would see several hundred clerks and accountants and directors scuttling about at work, nothing too exciting. But this was the home of an economic giant, the British East India Company. The East India Company was established in the time of Shakespeare, but from the 1700s onward, it effected the greatest corporate takeover of all time. The company became the masters of India itself, ruling the whole subcontinent, over hundreds of millions of people. But being a joint stock company, they felt no responsibility to serve the people that they ruled over, only to return value to their London shareholders. And so within a few years, they bled the country dry. William Dalrymple is here. William is a Scottish historian and curator who's lived in India for much of his adult life. And he says that this was the supreme act of corporate violence in world history. His new book is completely fascinating. It tells the story of how a group of financiers from a poor and damp and economically irrelevant island on the outer rim of Europe came to completely dominate the richest and most powerful empire in the world, and in the process gained an empire for themselves. William Dalrymple's book is called The Anarchy. Hello, William.
Hello.
One of the myths you want to explode right at the outset is that the British conquered India. It was worse than that, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's a much more sinister story. We've always, I think, both in Britain and in India, seen this as the British with a capital B. But the East India Company was no more the British than Facebook is the Americans. It is a company. It is one of the very first joint stock companies.
The thing that strikes me about it is the sheer improbability of it all. It's as though like a small New Zealand wine and cheese company took over the United States.
Yeah, I mean, it's
that is exaggerating,
exactly that,
am I?
That's you're not exaggerating. That is literally the scale of it. Just to give you an idea, when the company is founded in 1599, Elizabethan England generates about 3% of the world's GDP. At the same time, the Mughal Empire, which controls not just modern India, but modern Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Afghanistan, and even a slither of Persia, is generating about 37, 38% of world GDP. In other words, more than a third. And it's just overtaken China as the world's leading industrial producer. And what it makes most of all, I mean, as well as being, you know, a centre of incredible aesthetic beauty, the world out of which the Taj Mahal is built, out of that incredible aesthetic sense that the Mughals developed, you get these world-beating textiles, silks, painted textiles called kalamkaris, and these things begin to be shipped around the world by the East India Company. In a sense, they're the shippers. But they grow to be the biggest capitalist organisation in the world. They grow to control half of London's imports and exports. They are the biggest employer in Britain. They turn themselves into the biggest narco operators in the world, just as a little sideline, make the Colombians look like rank amateurs. The Medellin cartel was nothing on the East India Company. And they start growing opium in the conquered provinces of Eastern India. They ship it illegally to China, in the process fighting opium wars to control Hong Kong as a base for their narco operations. And the Chinese government want opium imported into China about as much as Trump wants crack cocaine unleashed on the streets of New York and Chicago.
We don't know for sure if that's not true, but
well, we presume. You're right. In this government, you never make any assumptions. But certainly, they then use the profits from that to buy tea, which they ship back to India, to Europe, and finally to America, and it's East India Company tea that's dumped in Boston Harbor. So this is a story not just of the conquest of India by one corporation. It's the story of the growth of the corporation as an idea. It's the world's first multinational corporation. It's also the origin of everything that most terrifies us about corporations. The East India Company invents corporate lobbying. They're the first people to invent corporate corruption. This is the very first case of a company trying to bend a legislature to its will with using its money power. It's the first organization to involve heavily in insider trading. When Clive hears about the Battle of Buxar, that's the commander of the East India Company in India, hears about the victory of the East India Company over the Mughal Empire, his first action is not to tell London about this great victory, it's to write to his agent in London in cipher and tell him to mortgage all his property and buy East India Company shares. And so, I mean, everything that we are most frightened about in corporations comes from this one incredibly ruthless, evil, successful, world-changing East India Company.
Now, you say it starts at this meeting in London in 1599. This is the time of Shakespeare. This is the time of Queen Elizabeth I is on the throne. What happened at that meeting?
So, you're right. So, this is 24th September 1599, Moorgate Fields, that is now a rather grubby tube station, but in those days, as its name suggests, was a patch of agricultural land on the edge of London. And there was a beautiful half-timbered building called the Founders Hall. And a young man called Customer Smythe has hired this for the day and called a public meeting. And he's appealing to the patriotic sentiments of Elizabethan London and asking them all to invest their savings in a new venture to beat the Dutch and to take an expedition to the East Indies and buy spices.
This isn't India. This is an expedition to Southeast Asia, to the East Indies,
correct,
to the Moluccas.
And the initial title of the company is the Company of London Merchants Sailing to the East Indies. In other words, Java, Indonesia. That, at that time, is the centre of the spice trade. For centuries, people have grown nutmeg and pepper there, and cinnamon and all sorts of other things which flavour food. In the old days, they used to be shipped up the Red Sea to Egypt, and then from Cairo would find its way either to Aleppo or to Venice and make its way to Europe. At each stage, people would add, you know, their commission onto this. And the Dutch realized you don't need to do any of this. You can just sail right around the Cape of Good Hope, go straight to Java, buy some cheap pepper from the producers and ship it back to Europe at huge cost. And Customer Smythe is extremely anxious about this, the man who calls this meeting, because he has already founded something called the Levant Company, and that is involved in the trade with Cairo and Aleppo. And suddenly he realizes that, you know, this company that he's founded is worthless. So to save the day, he gathers the people of London at the Founders Hall and invites them all to contribute.
Now, what kind of people are these shareholders, these first investors in the East India Company? Are they big business types or smaller investors?
Well, it's a good question, because with Levant Company, they were the big business guys. They were 35 friends of his who owned ships and were the oligarchs of Charing Cross, if you like. But the guys who are called to this meeting is the whole of London. And he has a completely different business model that's only been tried three times before. And this is the joint stock company. A very common idea today, but it's an invention of Tudor England. It's a brand new idea at the time. A whole bunch of people who had no executive part in the running of this business, who were not wool merchants or traders in spices or anything of the sort. They were vintners, skinners, haberdashers, grocers.
Right, what are the kind of people that our politicians call mum and dad investors? Right.
Exactly that. It's mum and dad in the corner shop. Mm. And they're all putting in £5, £10, £3. And they gather enough money to buy some ships. So they go off the next day to Deptford Docks, and there they see a creaky old hulk called the Mayflower, which they reject as unseaworthy. That, of course, disappears from history. We never hear about that again. And instead, they buy a pirate ship, which I'm not making this up, is called the Scourge of Malice, you know, sort of Jack Sparrow's flagship.
An honest-to-God pirate ship.
Honest-to-God pirate
right.
ship, genuinely.
Okay. Right.
And most of the sailors they recruit are pirates. They describe themselves as privateers in the when they're writing down their names at the entrance to this meeting. First of all, they rename the Scourge of Malice the Red Dragon, and they sail off down the Thames, and just off Dover, the wind gives out, and it's the middle of summer, there's no wind, so they just sit off Dover for a couple of weeks. Everyone laughs at them and says, right, you know, write a bunch of, you're never going to make it to the East Indies. But the wind picks up, they do make it to the East Indies, and they see this Portuguese ship coming in the opposite direction, and being a bunch of ex-pirates, they literally just board it, move all the spices from that ship into theirs, and then they sail home and sell it for £1 million.
So they didn't even get to the East Indies. What, they just raided a Portuguese ship?
They were nearly there, but they raided
stole their stuff and yeah. came home with it, right?
Exactly that.
So mission accomplished, I suppose.
Mission accomplished the old English way.
Right. So why didn't they keep doing that? Why didn't they keep just going to the East Indies and getting spices?
Well, they do for about 30 years, but it's increasing diminishing results because the Dutch I've been there before them. The Dutch have bigger ships, deeper pockets. This is the golden age of Holland. This is Rembrandt's time, and all those pictures of nice gentlemen skating on ice with, you know, with hats on and all that sort of thing. The Dutch beat the English out of the East Indies.
They were locked out.
They were locked out. Yep. They were bombed and cannonaded out. And so there's this face-saving treaty when the English hand over to the Dutch the island of Run, the source of all the nutmeg in the world. And it's considered a major loss. And in return, there's a face-saving sort of proviso. They get a muddy island in the Hudson River, which is, of course, Manhattan, which turns out to be an all right investment in the long term.
That worked out okay in the end, yes.
But in the absence of the spice trade, having been basically forced out by the Dutch, they fall back on what then is the second best trade in that part of the world, which is textiles. And this is the best thing that's ever actually happened to the company, because they get into this trade just as the Mughal Empire is reaching its peak and turning into an industrial giant. What Manchester will be in the 19th century, the workshop of the world, Bengal is in the 18th century.
So they arrive, they send a trade mission to meet the emperor of the Mughal Empire, who's in Delhi, and he, as you say, he's like the most powerful man in the world, probably.
The richest and the most powerful man in the world. Akbar, his father, described the English as an assembly of savages, which is a description that you'll hear echoed for quite a few years after this.
So how was it for these English traders to get the emperor's attention?
Well, I mean, it's very significant that the English account of this meeting goes into almost book-length form, that Sir Thomas Rowe, the diplomat in charge, writes this first detailed account of the glories of the Mughal Empire. He describes Jahangir, the emperor, literally fettered in gold. It's almost as if he's sort of locked up in chains of gold. He's got so much. But in Jahangir's equally voluminous diaries, there's not even a mention of the English. I mean, no one notices them. They are totally, you know, savages from the further world. Oh, one thing that Jahangir does take an interest in, because he likes a tipple, he asks about beer, and there's a long conversation about English beer which takes place.
All right, so but that's out of sheer politeness, I suppose.
That was out of pure politeness.
Yeah, sheer politeness. Yeah. So was there any chance of the English being able to make an impression by force of arms? Did they have better guns or something at that point?
Absolutely not. The Mughal Empire has 4 million men under arms, and they're, you know, incredibly sophisticated.
Four million men.
It's one of the great armies of world history. The English are no more than, you know, grubby northern traders hanging around the fringes, along with lots of other grubby northerners, the Portuguese, the Germans, the Baltic states, the Danish have an East India Company, the French have an East India Company, and the Dutch, of course. So for the first 100 years, the British are minor players, but they get the hang of this textile trade, and they start founding factories, they call them, which turn into ports, which turn into major towns, including Calcutta, Bombay, and Madras. And by the early 18th century, when the Mughal Empire is reaching peak production, the British are shipping so much Mughal material out of the country, particularly the textiles, particularly cotton, that there's actually deindustrialization in Mexico because of the sheer amount of Indian goods which are being exported by the company. So Britain...
Sorry, did you say deindustrialization in Mexico as a result of this vast export of Indian textiles?
Of Indian Mughal textiles. And so the British initially come to power on the back, parasitical, on the success of Mughal industry. Today we tend to think of India as a rising economic power, but we don't think of it as an industrial giant in the same way that we think of China. That is exactly what India was in the Mughal Empire. It was the world's greatest center of industry, producing 1 million weavers in Bengal alone, producing textiles of such beauty and sophistication that no one else in the world could match them. I mean, down to these gorgeous gauze dupattas that you see in Mughal miniatures, which women wear, and you can see their figures underneath them. And this is called buffed hawa, woven air, so light and translucent. And, you know, this is a sexy, rich, sophisticated society. And initially, the company is just shippers for these guys. They do the dirty work behind the scenes, moving this stuff around to Europe and beyond and to the Americas.
So the question comes now. What happened? There's this empire that is the richest and most powerful in the world. Everything about them is full of power, art, and culture and money and gold and jewels and all of this, they're unassailable. The English are not even worth their notice. How does this great empire fall?
Two things happen, and at the same time. The first thing is that the Mughal emperor Aurangzeb, who's this fierce, bigoted Islamic Puritan who breaks up the empire by his bigotry. Up to this point, the Mughals have been incredibly tolerant. They have got the Rajput Hindus as their own warriors to fight for them. They've ended all the old-fashioned Mughal taxes on different faiths and genuinely created a kind of multicultural state out of pragmatism, which conquers the whole of South Asia and Afghanistan. But Aurangzeb rips up the foundations of that by putting back the tax on Hindus, knocking down Hindu temples, but also expanding far too far into the far south of the country, exhausting his own war machine. And in the process, he unleashes a whole rebel movement. First of all, the Marathas, who come out of these hill forts on the western coasts. Then you have the Sikhs rising up in the Punjab, the Jats and the Doab. And suddenly the whole country is at war with itself. And at that moment, the neighbours take an interest, particularly one man who is this incredible warrior called Nader Shah. And Nader comes out of Persia, as he says, to pluck some golden feathers from the Mughal peacock's tail. And he comes through Afghanistan, down the Khyber Pass, and at the Battle of Karnal, he's met by 1.5 million Mughal cavalry waiting for him. And he has only about 150,000, but the Mughals are all, you know, have got all the kind of dancing women, all the society has arrived in Karnal to see the action. And with the Persian army, it's just crack troops who've come all the way. They're battle hardened. Plus, they've got the latest military gizmo, which is something called the swivel gun, which has an armor piercing capacity, which the Mughals don't know about. So in this big battle, on the final day, the Mughal army draws up across the plains. It's a bright, sunny day. You can imagine the armor glinting in the sun, and they get into a trot, then into a canter, and finally into a full gallop. And at the last minute, the light Persian cavalry part like a curtain, revealing these swivel guns in a line, resting on tripods on the horses' heads. This is the latest military technology of the day. 5 minutes later, it's all over. The cream of Mughal chivalry lie dead on the ground. And that night, Nader Shah invites the Mughal emperor to dinner. The idiot goes with just a few musicians and bodyguards. They're disarmed. The next day, they march into Delhi, and 6 weeks later, Nader Shah leaves Delhi with 8,000 wagons full of gold, jewels and silver. Everything that the Mughals have plundered from the rest of India, all the treasury, the peacock throne, the Kohinoor diamond now in the Queen's crown in the Tower of London, the Daria Noor, which is in the state jewels of Tehran, the great Mughal diamond, which is now in the state jewels in the Kremlin. I mean, the greatest jewel collection in the world just is taken away. And it's as if the engine room of the Mughal Empire is shut down. There's no money to pay for the troops, no money to pay for the civil service. And you could as well imagine throwing a large Baroque mirror out of a second floor window, and you see that beautiful mirror just shatter into 1,000 pieces. That is what happens to the Mughal Empire. And it is the company waiting on the coast, up till then a very minor play in all this, that who begins to hoover up these little fragments and begin to start dominating first the coasts and then slowly move inland.
What were they doing while all these civil wars and raids were going on with the Mughals?
Well, while the Mughal Empire was breaking up, something was happening in Europe, and that was a couple of wars which, you know, you read about in history books, the War of the Austrian Succession, the War of the Spanish Succession. And what's important about there is that Frederick the Great revolutionizes warfare. He invents a whole load of gizmos, like bayonets on the end of muskets, mobile horse artillery that can be dragged around a battlefield.
Concentration of artillery fire, that's another one.
Concentration of artillery fire. Yeah. 18th century Enlightenment mathematics being used to scientifically control ballistics and so on. And the French are the first to realize that this can simply be imported to India. It's not rocket science. You just train up a bunch of Indians to do this for you. And so in the Battle of the Adyar River in 1740, the French for the first time unleashed this stuff on India. And I think 700 French sepoys destroy an army of 30,000 Mughal cavalry. And from that point, everyone in India knows that the East India companies, French and English, really can't be defeated in battle. It takes about 30 years for Indians to catch up. And in that time, the English and the French battle each other, and the English eventually kind of seize Bengal, which is the richest place in the world at that point. And Bengal, which had been the source of all the finance for the Mughal Empire, now becomes the source of finance for the British East India Company's attempt to seize India.
This is where one of the great heroes of the British Empire steps in, a man called Robert Clive. Clive of India, as he's known, and celebrated, or was celebrated, anyway, in
England. As seen on Australian curry paste.
Is he on the...
Clive of India curry. I didn't know about this till this week. Whenever I mention him, people suddenly come up with pictures of Clive curry paste.
Best take that off now, I think, just quietly. But tell me a bit about him and the kind of man he was before he was sent to India with the East India Company.
The Victorians whitewash and spin this tale. And Clive, who was well known to be a sort of, you know, ruthless scoundrel in the 18th century, is given a sort of new coat of paint in the 1890s and turned into this hero that we all learnt about at school.
But what was he really like?
So he was like, I mean, imagine, you know, the Godfather set in 18th century Market Drayton. Sort of provincial Shropshire.
And so he's a low-rate gangster, in other
words. He's a kind of village thug.
Right.
And he is famous with his friends for throwing stones through the windows of shops who don't pay him protection money. And even at one stage, as an adolescent, lying down in front of a rain-filled gutter and diverting the floodwaters into somebody's shop just to flood it to show that what he could do.
Did he suffer some mental illness? Because he did try and kill himself at some point.
He's a man of incredible violence. And that's clear right from the beginning. His uncle writes these despairing letters when he's a teenager. And his family realise there's no way he's going to make it in the church, not even in the law, ship him off to India, where he turns his innate violence on himself initially, because he's so miserable as a chartered accountant sitting in Madras. Twice he tries to kill himself, doesn't quite succeed. And it's only when the French capture Madras and he manages to escape in disguise, make it to some other East India Company outpost and fight back, that suddenly his talents are realised. Because this man is a brilliant military strategist, totally untrained, totally intuitive. But he does what no one else does in the 18th century. 18th century, it's still, warfare is very formal. It's like a chess game. There's treaties and negotiations. Clive hasn't got time for any of that. He attacks at night. He attacks in the middle of thunderstorms. He attacks in the early morning from the rear through thick fog. And he knows how to inspire fear in his enemies. And he is incredibly ruthless, but also, like all good villains, and he really is my kind of Lord Voldemort in this book, he's also incredibly successful. He just calls it right each time. He's very good at judging his opponents, knowing how to frighten them, knowing how to beat them. And I set him off against the other sort of anti-hero of the book, who is the Mughal Emperor, Shah Alam. And Clive is this brute. I mean, in all his he's a very good letter writer, but there's no sense in his letters of the beauty of India. He's just talking money, profit, violence, and strategy.
In some ways, he might be the first corporate psychopath then.
He is. That's so. A very good phrase, which I might lift yes. from now on.
Yes. Yeah. Like, he seems to be completely without compassion of any kind. He very much on task, very much on focus.
Doesn't Kerry Packer care. With infantry. What's Rupert Murdoch with nuclear submarines. I mean, choose your...
That's him set loose in India. Can you just explain? He never intended to conquer Bengal, did he? It was an accident, actually.
So this is a very important part of the story, because India is in chaos at this point. The Mughal Empire is breaking up. It's town against town, province against province, village often against village, dog eat dog. And in the middle of this, the company is, while being ruthless, a plundering, asset-stripping corporation. It's also a little island of calm, because its settlements are not being raided. There are law courts running in the centre of them, which Indian businessmen can use to defend their commercial contracts and so on. And very early on, Indian financiers realise that these are people they can do business with. They talk the same language of debt, interest, commercial contracts and so on.
Well, they're deeply unsentimental people, in other words.
They may be different religions, but ultimately their lives are both about money. And Calcutta at this point is a bit like Dubai or Singapore today. No one pays tax. It's a free trade port. And bankers are coming pouring in from all over India because of the opportunities that, this sort of ruthless capitalist libertarian centre holds for them. And when Clive sails north in 1756 to take on the local Nawab Siraj Daulah, who's captured Calcutta, and then also to take on the French, who are the national enemy of the British. At the end of this very successful expedition, when Clive defeats both, the head banker of Bengal, who is a man called the Jagat Set, which simply means the banker of the world, who's like the kind of Rothschild of India, who has invented some very clever financial instruments for transferring money around India and taking enormous chunk of 10% each time he does so. He just simply gets in touch with Clive and says, look, I don't like this guy, Siraj Daulah. He's threatened to circumcise me if I don't lend him the money that he wants. And this is enough, obviously, to focus most men's minds. And he just says to Clive, I will pay you £2 million if you get rid of him. So Clive, without consulting the directors in London or consulting his bosses in Madras, simply marches north for 3 days, fights the Battle of Plassey, which has already been set up. His principal general facing him is the man who will replace Siraj Daulah if this coup is successful. And the Jagat Sets let him into the treasury in Murshidabad, the capital of Bengal. And Clive just walks through filling his pockets. They then empty most of the contents into a series of barges, which they float down river 2 days to Calcutta. When he's later questioned about this in Parliament by outraged MPs, Clive stands up and says, my lords, I was astonished at my own moderation. So you get the guy. You know, this is a totally shameless corporate monster. And the father of, you know, a million other totally shameless corporate monsters.
Podcast, broadcast, and online. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. Hear more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
So before you were explaining, William, how suddenly, almost by accident, the East India Company found themselves in control of Bengal and Calcutta, that whole region of the richest part of India around the north there.
And there's another battle about 8 years later, the Battle of Buxar, when the Mughal emperor, the Nawab of North India, this guy called Shuja Daulah, and the new Nawab of Bengal all gather together in a great alliance to take on the company. And to their surprise and horror, they are defeated too, despite the fact that they outnumber the company about 100-1. And suddenly the company finds that they've got India. They've got the whole of North India and that it's theirs to do what they will. So what do they will? As being corporates, they decide that they're just going to asset strip it. And so from 1765 till 1770, 5 years, they pick it to the bone. They're shipping home in excess of about 150,000 each year, which is this huge drain of wealth. And so when you go to England today and you go to one of those beautiful National Trust houses that looks as if Colin Firth is about to step out of it wearing a billowing white shirt or wade through a lake or something, a lot of this stuff is built at this period. Those lovely Georgian pyramids and obelisks and pediments that you see, these are all the products of the loot of India. And it's a hugely successful business model. No longer do they have to ship out gold and silver from England to buy expensive, high-quality Indian textiles. Instead, they just tax the Indians that they've conquered. And with the profits of that, they buy the silks and the kalamkaris and the opium and everything else they want to trade. And so they're making a huge profit on free goods, as far as they're concerned. They're not paying for this stuff. They're just collecting it in tax. It's a win-win model as far as the company is concerned. But of course, the victim is India. India is left, particularly eastern India, Bengal, previously the richest province in India, is reduced to beggary in 5 years.
They were taxing the local people as the rulers with the taxes, buying the goods that they would normally purchase with British gold. How long did that last? How long could they sustain this kind of parasitic rule over Bengal?
Not very long. They maintain rule in Bengal, obviously, up until 1947, when India finally becomes independent. But this level of plunder, this completely unregulated asset stripping, is only sustainable for as little as 6 years. And from 1764 till 1770, enough of India is asset stripped, looted, and plundered that the English company Whistleblower, who's the first guy to really write about what's going on, says that by that time, the bones of Bengal had been picked clean.
And then what happens then? How bad do things get? And so they've killed this golden goose.
So they've killed the goose. And in 1770, there is the most catastrophic famine. Not directly the company's fault, but in India, where famines are quite regular, any responsible ruler has reserves of grain, which they make available to the people. They ship in grain from elsewhere. And quite often, they have major building projects, paying people a rupee a day so that they can survive the famine and plant again another year. And the following year, life will return. But the company, being a crudely extractive corporation, doesn't see its responsibility to set up soup kitchens or ship a single boat full of grain from Upper India, where it's cheap and available, to Bengal, where there's nothing.
It's just all returned to shareholders. That's it, is it? That's their sole responsibility in their
mind. Of course. I mean, there's no rhetoric about, you know, the later Victorian Raj has this rhetoric about building railways and, you know, bringing Western civilization to the East and all this bullshit. The company doesn't try to pull any fast ones like that. They are a company. They're as much about profit as Goldman Sachs is today.
But this is the thing that really just does my head in. I mean, there's no long-term sense in this, even for them as a extractive wealth company. Surely there's a benefit for them in, even 5 years down the track, if they just keep the thing at least bumping along, for them to keep extracting wealth from it.
Well, I think, you know, obviously the famine wasn't planned. It wasn't that they created the famine deliberately, but they do nothing to stop it. There's no, literally not one soup kitchen is set up anywhere. And individually, one or two company men may do it in their gardens privately, but the company as an institution does not set up one soup kitchen.
So all the East Sea grains being eaten, all the cattle that normally you would produce other cattle from is eaten as well, and that's that, is it?
And as a result, by the summer, first of all, 20,000, 100,000, half a million Bengalis are dead. The streets of Calcutta are filled with rotting corpses. Dogs and vultures are picking at bones by the side of the Ganges. There are whole skies blackened with flies and vultures. And it's sufficiently horrific. I mean, people have never seen anything like this ever before. And it's sufficiently horrific that it tweaks the conscience of enough company men that you begin to get letters being written to the Gentleman's Magazine, to the Tatler, to the Spectator, to the English press. And by 1771, there is widespread horror in London at what's going on. People have been very happy up to now to just to know that, you know, a third of English customs money comes from East India Company goods and the taxes the company pays to the Crown. And because no one can go to India without an East India Company passport, there's very little independent reporting. I mean, there's no sort of foreign correspondence coming out and reporting on what the company's getting up to at the Battle of Buxar. It's only the company's own memoirists who are writing their heroic tales of conquest and glory. But now it changes because, you know, so many people have died. The situation is so horrific. The you know, Calcutta looks like a scene from a Hieronymus Bosch hell scene. And suddenly everything goes wrong. The company goes bankrupt because there's no profits coming out of Bengal anymore. They have to appeal to the government. You have plays in the Haymarket Theatre where Lord Clive is lampooned as Lord Vulture. You have a parliamentary inquiry. Clive is brought into parliament and cross-questioned. And in the end, because of its greed, because it's screwed up through its stupid level of greed, its short-termism, a regulating act is passed. And for the first time, the government begins to sit on the head of the East India Company. And what has been a libertarian dream of totally unregulated free market capitalism at its most ruthless now begins to become, and eventually by the end of the century, does become a sort of public-private partnership. And ultimately, in 1858, the whole thing is rolled up the great uprising of 1858, Parliament steps in and just abolishes the company.
And that's that. So you're saying London knew. London knew what was going on with that grotesque famine that was, they did nothing about, they did nothing to fix.
It's interesting because the biggest surprise to me, I think, researching it, was not the plunder, the loot and all the evil that goes on. The surprise is how outraged London is at this point, because no one's really been bothering to find out where this money is coming from.
All this lovely money keeps coming in.
All this money's coming in, everyone's happy, taxes are paid, big houses are popping up, the country is becoming richer, you know, the balance of payments are all positive. So
Royal Navy is flourishing.
Everything's great. You know, it's absolutely fantastic as far as the British are concerned. And no one's really looking down the other end of the telescope to see what it's like from the Bengal point of view. Suddenly, in 1772, with this bankruptcy, I mean, several things are happening. First of all, there are reports of the famine, and they're horrific. Secondly, still these nabobs are shipping their fortunes home. A record amount is exported, 150,000 the year of the famine. Incidentally, in the middle of it, the shareholders are so thrilled that in the first year that their land revenues are maintained at the point of a bayonet, that they vote themselves an increased dividend from 10% to 12.5%. In the middle of a million people dying. Thirdly, the company itself has gone bankrupt. It is literally too big to fail.
So having bankrupted their source of revenue, they then come and ask for a bailout?
So having bankrupted their source of revenue, having shipped private fortunes home to build yet more gorgeous country houses in the English home counties, they then go to Parliament and say, we need £10 million because otherwise we're bankrupt. So, I mean, this combined wakes up the whole of Britain to what's going on. So Horace Walpole, the Whig diarist, writes, "We have outdone in horrors the Portuguese and the Spanish in the New World. They at least had the excuse of faith. We have done it only for profit."
This is so, so relevant to the present time, to the crash of 2008, and all these phrases that we can easily impose back on the past, like too big to fail. This is what had happened. The British East India Company had become too big to fail. So did the government have to bail them out in the end? They actually had to do that, did they?
I mean, obviously they didn't have to, in the sense they could have let it go, but they didn't for the same reason that the British government bailed out NatWest 10 years ago. Which is that it is the main employer in the country. The whole country's economic value would have sunk without trace.
And how many of the British members of the British Parliament were shareholders?
40%.
40%.
So of course they're not going to let their pet company disappear because it's been their main source of their investment. So by voting to bail out the company, they're also voting to bail out themselves. It's hugely self-interest. And the company is the first company to really understand how to use Parliament to its own ends. In the same way that in the 20th century, we've seen so many companies persuade states to intervene and make what is the interest of the shareholders mysteriously become the interests of the state. And, you know, we've seen that over and over again. 1953, the Anglo-Persian oil company is about to be nationalized by Mossadegh, the first democratic ruler in Iran. What happens? The CIA and MI6 combine to create a coup. Mossadegh is killed. The Shah is brought in. The Anglo-Persian oil company is not nationalized. 1955, United Fruit controls 45% of the agricultural land in Guatemala. The new socialist government is voted in that wants to do land redistribution to landless peasants. The CIA produces another coup. The socialist government is overthrown in a coup d'etat. And the phrase banana republic is born. ITT is threatened by Salvador Allende's reforms in Chile. The CIA yet again intervene. A right-wing coup takes place. A horrid human rights abusing junta is put in its place. And Allende is killed. ITT's interests increase. So that sort of world where corporate interests can cause security agencies and big powers to simply topple whole governments, that world is created by the East India Company. The world where corporate lobbyists are constantly at work chipping away, bribing, lunching, taking out, whispering in the ears of MPs and ministers. And altering foreign policy, the whole strange way in which, for example, the Bush government decides to invade Iraq after 9/11, although Saddam Hussein has absolutely nothing to do with 9/11. Mysteriously, Saddam Hussein is invaded and ExxonMobil suddenly turns up in Iraq as a big player in the Iraqi oil fields. So that world, which every democratic country knows because of campaign contributions, where corporations are in this strange, intimate dance with the state, at some points controlling the state or influencing the state, at other times the state is forcing the hand of corporations. That dance begins here with the East India Company. And all the things we most fear about corporations, the way that they're listening to our messages and on our mobile phones, that world, you know, has its origins in the company.
At the height of the East India Company's power, early 19th century, before the British Raj, before the British Raj actually have to step in, there are scenes in a lot of beautiful British novels, which I adore, like Jane Austen novels, where people are sitting down having a lovely cup of tea. What role does the British East India Company have in creating that lovely tea with sugar in it?
So, you're sitting in Mansfield Park, and your handsome Colin Firth hero is coming towards you and offering you a cup of tea. In that teapot is tea grown in China. To buy that tea, the East India Company has taken over great chunks of land in Bengal, which has turned into monoculture opium production. Lots of land which had previously been given up for food is now producing opium. As a result, there's far less food to go around in India, and famines are much more likely. The people working in the opium factories, treading opium, become opium addicts themselves, and their lives are very short and unpleasant, as are the lives of those, of course, who buy the opium in China. But with the profits of that, tea is bought, which is shipped to India, to Europe, England, and to the Americas. Meanwhile, the other end of the world, in the Caribbean, cousins, often from the same family, the elder brothers of the people that have gone out to India, have found work in Caribbean slave plantations.
The West Indies. Yes.
Entire populations of black Africans have been shipped over the Middle Passage, many dying en route, others horrifically treated on arrival, raped, branded, forced into hard labour in order to grow the sugar, which goes into the same cup of tea, plus, of course, cotton in order to clothe the lady in the lovely crinolines who is sipping it. So behind the price of a cup of tea is very, very steep if you are Indian, Chinese or African, or frankly anything other than a white European. And I think it's incredibly important that the British know this, because we have in my country this fantastic ability to whitewash our own past, that, you know, we are horrified by what the French did in Algeria. The Belgians were far worse in the Congo, and the Germans even worse in the Sudetenland. But somehow the British Empire was all different. It was all merchant ivory with ladies in parasols walking down lawns, all those wonderful clubs with chaps in tweeds sitting there.
And there's the gift of parliament and democracy and law.
Railways.
Cricket.
And all that. But the reality is, of course, much darker, which is not to say there were not some things that were. I mean, when the British left India in 1947, unquestionably it had the best education system, the best communications and the best healthcare in Asia. But the Indian economy has contracted from, you know, nearly 40% to about 7% of world GDP. And there, on the way, at various points, there have been not only the great famines of 1770, but in 1857, about 300,000 innocent Indian civilians are shot down by East India Company troops in the retributions that follow the great uprising of that year. And none of this is taught in British schools. When I went to school, I learned about Plassey as a glorious story, but my kids don't even study the empire. They move from studying the Tudors to studying the Nazis, with a brief stop on the way when they learn how the British ended the slave trade.
Right.
As if the whole story of British history was, you know, an amazing movement against racism. And I think this is not only, you know, is it living in cloud cuckoo land and generating a willful ignorance about our past, it's also, in a sense, responsible, I think, partly for the mess we're in at the moment with Brexit and everything. This sense of British exceptionalism, as if we were some incredibly benign force in world history that is now being slightly sullied by this association with tricky foreigners in Europe. And I think unless you do teach people the dark side of their past, as well as the good things, you know, in Australia, learning about the mass wipeout of the Tasmanian Aboriginals. I mean, that sort of stuff needs to be known alongside whatever positive things happen in terms of development and port building and city building and so on. Likewise in Germany. I mean, Germany, you know, every German kid learns about the Holocaust. And that is a very important thing. It means the Germans can move into the modern world, you know, with people that know what they've done, with a sense of the darkness in their history, as well as the glories of Beethoven and Goethe and all the other things that Germany has contributed to civilization. And in a sense, Germany is free from that baggage as a result. But the British have never had this reckoning.
What about India? I mean, you lived in India for much of your life, for most of your adult life. Is there a willingness to hear the story of how complicit a great many of their rulers were with the British East India Company in enslaving, destroying their own power?
Well, this is, I mean, I've just come back from a book tour in America, then England, then India, now here. And in England, I was very much emphasizing the loot and the pillage, because I think the British do need to know that. But in India, I was emphasizing the degree of collaboration and complicity, and the fact that the Marwaris are helping the British pull off this audacious move. And just to be clear about this, there are never more than 2,000 white Brits in India. They... India, never more than 2,000.
Really?
During the company period. And they borrow money from Indian bankers to train up Indian troops to fight other Indians. And at the peak of the company's power, the company's army has 200,000 brown Indian soldiers fighting other Indians, paid for by Indian bankers, and only 1% white officer class.
And how does that compare to the size of the British Army at the same time?
The British Army is exactly, in 1799, exactly half that size. It is 100,000 troops.
So this private company has an army, a private army, that is twice the size of the British Army?
Correct. And gradually, by the early 19th century, the British wake up to the fact that this is not a sensible way to govern your colonies. And by the 1820s and 1830s, people are asking questions regularly in Parliament. You know, if India wasn't so far away, we would regard this as a major threat to the state. How have we allowed a bunch of London merchants in a boardroom to control our greatest colony? After all, Plassey was won partly by government troops. You know, the company wouldn't have this empire at all, but for occasional assistance by the British Crown. How come it went to the company rather than to become like the American empire, to be controlled by the Crown? So questions begin to get asked, and people begin to realise the absurdity of the system whereby one group of merchants in one London office block control a third of humanity.
To me, as I read this book, I have to say, William, the thing that really struck me was the power of that invention of the joint stock company. It's right up there with the steam engine, it seems to me, that other British invention, where you have energy that's kind of congealed in second case in coal, but in the other case, it's in energy and money that's congealed within the pool of capital that's put together by the joint stockholders that can then, it seems like it's like a sleeping dragon that's uncoiled, and all this enormous energy is unlocked from this process.
I mean, a better analogy might be nuclear power. Suddenly, yes, you find this source of energy which can change the world and which can be extremely dangerous. Now, in the story of the East India Company, it is ultimately the state which triumphs over this company. But today we're fighting these battles again. Elizabeth Warren is on the campaign trail at the moment in America, and every speech of her is about big tech, big data, big pharma, and the power of corporations such as Exxon, which, if it were a country, would be the 14th richest country in the world. And so these big corporations, you know, need regulation as much as the East India Company needs regulation. And yet each generation has to fight this battle anew, because the battle that we will have to control the power of Google or Facebook is quite different from the battle that the Victorians had to wage to control the East India Company.
In your book, there's a moment where I think it's a Nawab says to one of the British East India Company outposts, he said, "We're going to have to tax you properly from now on." And they whisper in his ear, "Mate, if you don't like how we're doing business here, we can easily move." Now, what does that remind you of, William?
It's Amazon. Amazon last year redoing its headquarters. You know, it doesn't want to pay tax in England, doesn't want to pay tax in Australia, because all its accounts are in the Cayman Islands. And if people don't like this, they can simply move their warehouses, which employ tens of thousands of people who would otherwise be unemployed, to somewhere else, a better tax regime that treats them better. So this is in the DNA of capitalism. It's in the DNA of corporations and companies. And we have to find ways, each generation, to fight this battle anew. To, just like you need laws to control human beings, it's in our DNA to eat, fight, reproduce, and put our DNA onto a new generation. It's in the DNA of corporations to make as much profit as they can and to fight regulation as strongly as they can by corporate lobbying and by other forms of influence. And who knows, even within the next generation, which is going to be more powerful, the state or the company?
Just finally, William, when a British Prime Minister goes to India to meet the Indian Prime Minister these days, how does he come to him?
Usually with a, these days, with a delegation of businessmen longing for contracts. And it's only then, really, that the British suddenly have to confront the question of whether they should be apologising about something. And at the moment, you're getting this very muddled response whereby the Queen or David Cameron goes to Jallianwala Bagh, the site of the greatest massacre in the 20th century. And they don't apologise, but they go and lay a wreath, which seems to be, you know, the worst possible sort of solution.
Well, like a tsunami happened here.
Either you go somewhere, and you know, this is a massacre of unarmed people by British troops or Gurkhas under British command.
So they treat it like a natural disaster, in other words.
Yeah,
like
just, I mean, you don't. It isn't a tsunami. Yeah. Someone took a decision to shoot dead unarmed people as a lesson.
I suppose what I mean, my question though, is in terms of economic power, how does that relationship work, given the size of India's economy now, given the dynamism of its economy, its economic growth rate and the like?
Well, India's economic growth is really still just in its beginning, its reawakening. But already China is there. China, you know, is the second biggest economic power in the world. They control your port at Darwin, as well as Trincomalee, Gwadar, and this string of pearls. Their naval power is growing every year. I don't need to tell you all this stuff. You know that. India will come. It'll take longer. It's an elephant rather than a cheetah or a tiger. But India's moment will come without question in the next century. And India will ultimately be the second power behind China. And Europe and America and Australia will all be slipping down the rankings. And what we have to realize is this is not some strange new wonder of modern development. This is just the reassertion of the two greatest economic powers in history, who underwent this brief blip in the 19th and early 20th century, when through a series of technological military developments, the West briefly edged out India and China. But in our own lifetimes, we're going to see that natural equilibrium change. And sadly for America, and even more sadly for Europe, which is slipping already well down the league, the days of gunboat diplomacy are long gone.
Such a pleasure to speak with you, William. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.